Hi, everyone, and welcome to a brand new podcast venture with myself, David Chen. And joining me today, as always, is Joanna Robinson. Joanna, how are you doing today?
I'm doing so well. How are you doing, Dave?
I'm good. So we're here today because we are considering launching a brand new TV recap podcast. The name of the podcast is going to be Peaks TV. And it will be located at peakstv.com. You can email us at peakstv@gmail.com. And this is going to be a recap podcast about American Gods, right, Joanna? No, I'm just joking. It's going to be about 2 weeks.
We're making... people definitely want to hear us argue more about American Gods.
It'll be about Twin Peaks. Uh-huh. And so why are we doing a Twin Peaks podcast? That's because not only is Twin Peaks a very revered cultural artifact and very beloved show, but Showtime is bringing it back starting May 21st for a third and theoretically final season. It's billing it as The Return, and there's going to be 18 episodes of Twin Peaks this year. David Leitch is involved. But Joanna Robinson, this is something that you're pretty passionate about. The show is something you're pretty passionate about. Why is that? What do you like so much about Twin Peaks?
Well, I didn't get into Twin Peaks when it first aired, like in the 90s. I think I was just a little too young for that phenomenon. But it is this incredibly influential show that, I mean, kind of famously crashed and burned. But it was this cultural phenomenon. And when you watch it, you can sort of understand why. It's, you see the DNA of so many shows that have followed in the, like, at the very least, the first season of the original Twin Peaks. This is where a lot of the stuff like theorizing and what I like to call yarnwalling, which is, you know, basically theorizing, came from. Like, if there had been a Reddit...
Yarnwalling? Can you explain yarnwalling?
Yeah, that comes from, like, you know how, like, crazy conspiracy theorists in films and television will have, like, a big board or wall where photos are connected by yarn and stuff like that. There's one in True Detective. Andrew Garfield's Spider-Man had one. Anyway, so I call it yarnwalling when you sort of go crackpot theorizing.
The two canonical yarnwall shows, yeah. True Detective and Amazing Spider-Man. Yep.
I try. If there had been a Reddit in the 90s, they would have gone bananas for this show because it centers on the mystery of the death of this teenage girl, Laura Palmer. It involves sort of weird, supernatural, surreal aspects but at its heart is a murder mystery. So... And just sort of like launched all this iconic, like, phrasing, imagery, and careers, in fact. So I just think Twin Peaks is really worth our attention. And I know a lot of people are sort of intrigued by the quote-unquote return on Showtime, but maybe have never seen the original. And so I thought it would be fun for us to sort of do a show where we, if we have time, watch the original and then watch the new one with people and sort of help them understand callbacks and references and what's going on. So,
right. A bold idea. Well, in order to do this, we need your help. And I think what I'm going to do is there's going to be Kickstarter for this podcast. And if you go to peakstv.com, I'll forward that domain to that Kickstarter. So just go to peakstv.com and you can back us. It's kind of the same Kickstarter we do for other shows like Cast of Kings. You can get a shout out. You can get some private time with us. But we would love to talk about Twin Peaks. And in order to do that, in order to commit the, I'm going to say, hundreds of hours that it's going to take to do justice to the show, we need your support. So again, peakstv.com is where you can support us. You'll probably have gotten a link to this episode via Twitter or Facebook or something like that. But in order to back us, peakstv.com is how you can do that. So to give a preview of what this podcast will be, we're going to take the rest of this time to recap the pilot of Twin Peaks, which we just watched Yesterday. I think we both watched it yesterday, right? I mean, obviously you've rewatched it. I've actually seen parts of it before. But yeah, let's talk about the pilot. This is, I think it's called Northwest Passage, but season yes. 1, episode 1, written and directed by David Lynch, originally aired in April of 1990. It had 34.6 million U.S. viewers.
Oh my God.
Really, like mind-boggling to consider today, right?
That's insane.
That's like the Super Bowl numbers today, right? I mean, I'm being facetious, but like it's a massive quantity of people, and so you can totally understand how this show took over, you know, the pop culture psyche.
Starz is considering a huge victory that they got just under 1 million viewers for American Gods. So, like, that's where we are now. That's what that, like, we're cheekily calling this podcast Peaks TV because it's Twin Peaks, but it's also leaning into the notion of peak TV and how much we have to watch right now. And you no longer have these massive cultural events, or they're few and far between, like Game of Thrones and The Walking Dead. But Twin Peaks was just everyone, not everyone, I guess, but so many people watched it. It's crazy.
Indeed. All right. I'm just going to read the plot summary here from Wikipedia of the pilot. In the feature-length pilot episode, it's 90 minutes, the small town of Twin Peaks, Washington, is shaken up when the body of high school student Laura Palmer is discovered near a riverbank wrapped in plastic. FBI agent Dale Cooper is called by local sheriff Harry Truman when Renette Pulaski, a schoolmate of Laura, is found wandering on a bridge and then slips into a coma. Cooper sees a connection between Laura's death and the murder of another girl 1 year earlier. After finding a piece of paper under Laura's fingernail, similar to one he found in the fingernail of the girl who died earlier, Cooper suspects that the same killer might have struck again. Meanwhile, Sheriff Truman arrests Laura's boyfriend, Bobby Briggs, who is secretly having an affair with a married woman named Shelley Johnson. Afterwards, Laura's mother has a terrifying nightmare. That is the plot of the first episode ever of Twin Peaks. So, Joanna, as you were rewatching this episode, what were the things that really stuck out to you about this show, this episode? Like, what insights came to you about why this show gripped so much of America back in the 1990s?
Well, a couple of things. One is the sort of the scope and the ambition of it. You know, so it's 90 minutes and the episode just introduces so many characters. Like, I know who all the characters are because I've seen the show, but you know, if I were a TV watcher watching now, I would be like, what? How dare you try to make me track all these characters in the first episode? I don't think TV shows are quite that ambitious anymore. And then also just, I see it as a bridge between, like, I don't know how many of our viewers or our listeners have watched like 80s primetime television, primetime dramas. You know, so this is 1990s, so we're headed out of the 80s into the 90s. But like nighttime dramas like Dallas or Dynasty or Falcon Crest or all these things were sort of really capturing the imagination of the American TV viewer. And you can see how Twin Peaks has some of that sort of primetime soap aspect to it, with these various affairs and who's cheating on whom and all that sort of stuff. But then you also see the weirdness that is David Lynch that he introduces. And so it's just a really fresh take on something that was kind of standard for the 80s. Does that make sense?
Yeah, let's talk about the weirdness. David Lynch, his movies have a lot of bizarre elements to them, both from a visual perspective but also from a plot perspective. He'll introduce characters or visual elements or just random stuff that occurs that just feels very off-kilter. It feels very disorienting, right? But compared to other David Lynch things that I've seen, like Blue Velvet or Mulholland Drive, Twin Peaks feels very restrained in this first episode. What do you think? Like,
First episode, certainly. I completely agree with you. And it was so funny because as I was watching it, I was like, oh, when does the weirdness start in this show? One thing I would say is sort of the step out of time aspect, because Lynch is kind of obsessed with this idea of uncovering the seedy underbelly of sort of bucolic suburbia or bucolic Americana. So what you see in this episode is a lot of like 50s and 60s wholesome America iconography, like specifically in the way that the character Audrey Horne, who's played by, hold on a second, I'm going to think of it. Sherilyn Fenn, right? You know, is dressed. She's dressed in like a long plaid. So she looks like she's right out of the 50s. The same is true of the teenage boys who look like greasers, right? But this is not a period drama. This is set in the 90s. So it's right. Sort of that weird step out of time feeling. The same is true of, is true of our main character, Agent Dale Cooper. He also just feels like a throwback. And the diner setting, all of it. The weirdness, I would say, I mean, the show gets much weirder, but some of the weirdness comes in, like, the introduction of Russ Tamblyn's character, who's Dr. Lawrence Jacoby. Like, when you meet him and he's got, like, the weird earplug sticking out of his ears, and he's just acting very strange and off-kilter.
Right.
That's some of it. The letter under the fingernail, stuff like that, like... You know, that I guess could be
conventional serial killer weirdness, I think.
I guess that could be in an episode of CSI, but I don't know. It's unsettling to me. Maybe I'm just projecting the weirdness that I know is coming onto this episode. What do you think?
Yeah, I thought it was – I think you're right about that guy, the doctor showing up with the earplugs and everything. He was very bizarre. I think – Dale Cooper speaking into a tape recorder that he refers to as Diane, I think. I don't think it's like clear who Diane is at this point in the series. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah. So yeah. I've not seen the rest. To be clear, right, I've not seen the rest of the show, so I don't know what the significance of Diane is. But he's not only dictating case details, but also details of his life into this tape recorder. That's kind of a weird thing to do that you don't see that many agents do. I really enjoyed the relationship between Dale Cooper and Harry Truman in this episode because so much of 90s cop shows had this dynamic between local cops and feds that was very adversarial. And you have the feds show up and they're like, well, you're not taking over my case. None of that happens here. It's a very civil relationship. I don't find it super weird as much as I find it atypical, But like I said, overall, I think from a Lynchian perspective, the restraint is very significant. It feels like when I watch this, I don't think to myself, oh, only David Lynch could have directed this. When I watch Mulholland Drive or when I watch Blue Velvet, I think that feels very Lynchian. This does not yet feel super Lynchian. I'm sure it will soon. But as of the pilot, that's not how I feel about the show.
I mean, I think you're right in terms of on the scale of weirdness. It's low on the scale of weirdness. Very low. I should mention, though, we do meet the log lady there in Corton. And Dale Cooper's like, who's that lady with the log? And the sheriff's like, we just call her the log lady.
I love that. And there's just no explanation.
There's no explanation.
Follow-up of what that is.
Right.
It just, she's a log lady. And then Dale Cooper is okay with it, too. He's just he doesn't even respond to that. So
the other theme of the other thing I want to talk about or touch on in terms of what I said before about sort of the seedy underbelly of bucolic America, is casting wise. I mean, that to me feels very Lynch, and you're right about the weirdness, but I think this other thing that he does so well in the likes of Blue Velvet, is really at play here. And the casting is so interesting because he's got the actor Russ Tamblyn playing Dr. Jacoby, who I just mentioned. And then he's got Richard Boehmer, who plays Ben Horne. Those are the two male leads of West Side Story. Like this iconic, like classic 60s America musical, which of course is like has tragedy in it. But like you've got Tony and Riff from West Side Story are like cast in this weird murder mystery. Like, I don't know, that to me feels like it has to be intentional. It's sort of fascinating. Lynch's fascination with that, with exposing America for what he thinks it really is very intriguing to me. And I'm really interested to see how that translates to 2017.
You mentioned how many characters the pilot introduces. I was very impressed as well. It feels like a very solid pilot. Just even evaluating it by modern day standards, it feels like it introduces a lot of characters. It sets them up pretty well. There's a bunch of threads that are left dangling to make you wonder, what really did lead to this death? Maybe it's connected to what happened Ronette. Maybe it's connected to this deal with the Norwegians. Like, there's all this stuff that is unknown, but it doesn't feel like an overwhelming amount of unknown. And we've seen shows like The X-Files, like Lost, and many other shows that deal heavily in mythology take a similar approach, where they will, hey, this is the table setting, and I have all these threads, and we're going to play them out and try to solve this ultimate mystery about who killed Laura Palmer. Also, another show that comes to mind is The Killing, which is not a show that I particularly enjoyed, but is something that I think clearly is inspired by something like Twin Peaks. So,
oh yeah, I mean Riverdale as well as an even more modern sort of thing. Riverdale, obviously, whereas it's Twin Peaks, but you're talking about like death in the Pacific, a death of a teenager in the Pacific Northwest. You can't help but think of Twin Peaks.
Typically, death of a white teenager as well.
Yeah, a white female. Yeah. Oh no, I guess in Riverdale it's a male. But I'm looking at this one review that came out at the time that I think is really, really nails it. And this is by Roger Hurlbert, who wrote in 1990, "The Lynchian sense of impending danger and kinky sexual undercurrents coupled with excellent music makes the Twin Peaks pilot work almost too well. You'll want to see the entire package in one sitting, but the series may lay an egg on television because of its drawn out and deliberate pacing, brutality, sex with violence, and a hit of something else. Something deadly, yet unseen, and probably repulsive." Mm. You know, it's so funny that it's like, this might not do too well because of sex and violence, little knowing that that's like exactly what we'll be looking for in our TV in the future. But
what was that review from, by the way?
Okay. The Florida Sun Sentinel.
Gotcha. So that review is from the Florida Sun Sentinel. And it is fascinating to look back in time and think of not only how different the sensibility was then, but how different TV was covered back then, right?
Oh, I mean, yeah.
Now there's dozens of websites that would have a detailed recap of it, whereas, you know, they probably only gave impressions of the pilot maybe in the finale back then, is my guess. I don't know. It seems like people back then knew that there was something special here, and maybe they had differing opinions as to how successfully it would do. You know, the throwback aspects you were talking about, I think the only thing that really kind of – it didn't bother me so much as it just made me, you know, kind of cock my head and be like, huh, is the acting style in this episode is very broad.
Yeah.
You know, it feels more like stage play style acting, if that makes sense, where all the emotions, all the line deliveries need to be very big is what I would say. And I don't think that's a problem, given that that seems to be what the show is going for. Sometimes it can be very cheesy. And more significantly, some actors seem to be in like a different show than other actors. So Dale Cooper, I think, and Harry Truman, very, very subtle. But then you have the boyfriend.
Bobby Briggs.
Yeah,
who
that guy. I just feel is so overblown. Is so broad, in terms of his performance, that it kind of it clashes with the believability of the other roles.
But it feels like it was directed that way because you've got someone like Grace Zabriskie, who I fell in love with when she was on Big Love, but she plays Laura's mother, Sarah Palmer, and she's also a big actor. I mean, she's dealing with a lot of big
emotions. Yeah, she's dealing with bigger emotions than I think the boyfriend is.
True. I mean, when I watched it the first time, I was like, who is this actor playing Bobby Briggs, and can we get rid of him, please? But he grows on me, actually. I agree with you. And that's sort of what makes me think of stuff like Dallas and Dynasty, which is this overblown soap style acting in the television. But then you have other people doing, a much more subtle work. Like, I think Sherilyn Fenn is really good. But even someone like even the character of Agent Dale Cooper, like, that's a mannered performance, right? Like, it's good, it's enjoyable, but it's very mannered, I would say.
It feels subtle to me in a way that Bobby Briggs does not. It feels, I guess, just more skillful to me. I don't know.
I think that's right. I mean, we wouldn't deny that Kyle MacLachlan is like one of the more talented people in the cast. But you see people like Lara Flynn Boyle get her start. And then you also see people sort of, you know, at the tail end of their careers, the two West Side Story actors that I mentioned, you've got Piper Laurie. And then you've got, you know, so it's a weird generational thing. One of the figures I find most alluring is the character played by Joan Chen. Joan Chen is like this just really, fascinating figure, I think, who plays the owner of
She plays Josie Packard,
who inherits the
sawmill, I believe, right?
Sawmill, yeah. And so she's just one of those figures. I feel like he's using her the way he often has used Isabella Rossellini in films, where it's just sort of like, just mysterious and just so beautiful, so just you just want to stare at her sort of thing. I don't know how to explain my reaction to Joan Chen in this show, but I think she's really, really dramatic.
She's very striking, for sure.
Yeah.
Another thing that stuck out to me about the pilot, Joanna, is the style, like how stylized it is in a good way. I mean, it feels like some filmmaking techniques are put to good effect. It does not feel like a conventional TV. It doesn't look like a multi-camera sitcom, but it doesn't even look like a regular procedural, in my opinion. It does not look like Law and Order, you know?
Right.
It looks like they're starting to use kind of really aesthetically attractive filmmaking techniques in telling a somewhat procedural story. I think of a bunch of shots that stick out to me. Runette wandering down the train tracks, you know, half naked from being assaulted. I think of the Laura Palmer's mom kind of storming up and down the stairs and looking up and down the stairs, that wide angle shot of the stairs that's very, very striking. It's just stairs in a house, but it is very striking to me. Even the opening credits, you know, with the sawmill doing its work, I just thought visually the show is very attractive, and I feel like this is kind of one of the first TV shows, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the first TV shows that really starts to apply this kind of expert filmmaking techniques from a visual perspective to the TV medium. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I know. I think that's an accurate thing to say. I mean, what's fascinating about this is it's so common now for us to see auteur filmmakers coming to television. This is just sort of like the order of the day now. But the fact that David Lynch, who had a successful commercially and critically film career, decided to do television in the 90s, in 1990, or I think actually pitched it originally in 88 or something like that. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
It was crazy at the time for David Lynch, who did, you know, The Elephant Man and Twin Peaks and Blue Velvet and all this sort of stuff, to then do a TV show. You know, that I imagine is why over 30 million people tune in to watch the first episode. So.
Yeah. So that was another thing that stuck out to me. And I did find the final shot or the final sequence of the episode to be very haunting, which is something that David Lynch does very, very well. I'm very unsettled by how his movies end, and this was no different. You know, just everything about it, from the editing, you know, the performance of Laura Palmer's mom, and the unearthing the necklace and the cut to credits, or the overlaying of credits on top of it, I just thought is very chilling and kind of a cliffhanger. You know, you need to know whose glove that was that reached down and pulled out that necklace from the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought the ending was very effective. Overall, I really enjoyed this first episode.
I'm so glad.
Yeah. Do you have any other sort of thoughts on what was remarkable or what was interesting about this episode?
I really just have to keep going back to the ambition of it. The ambition of having, like, introducing a character like Big Ed, whose wife has an eye patch and really needs the drapes hung. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, that's just like, what even is that? And it's in the pilot. You know, you're propelled forward by wanting to know who killed Laura. But just like any good murder mystery show or movie, like, it's not necessarily about that answer. And you know, this is something we talk about in the future in terms of Twin Peaks and what went wrong with Twin Peaks originally. But you're sort of along for the ride for all these like crazy characters that you meet along the way, and actually solving the murder is not in the end the most important thing that Twin Peaks has to offer.
Right. Right.
So
something that the only thing that I thought was curious, I wasn't necessarily bothered by it, but that I thought was curious was today we have things like Robert Downey Jr.'s Sherlock Holmes, we have Benedict Cumberbatch's Sherlock, and it feels to me like Special Agent Dale Cooper is kind of in that mold. He behaves quirkily. He seems to know things that no one else does, right, especially in this town.
You mean like noticing that a motorcycle was reflected in the like eyeball of someone in a low-res VHS tape? Yeah.
Yes, yes. And he also doesn't like really explain himself to others. But one thing that I just thought was a curious choice was firstly, I love watching characters like that. You know, it's to a point, it's fun to see someone dazzle people with their knowledge, but then they explain how they knew those things, right? You see Benedict Cumberbatch to Sherlock say, "Oh, well, you clearly just came from getting peed on, you know, because I see urine all over your lapel," or something like that. Good example. And so I think that part of the Dale Cooper character hasn't really materialized yet. He'll say things like, "Oh, this person didn't do it," but then he doesn't explain why he knows that, right? Just kind of have to accept it. And maybe he's going to explain in later episodes. But I did find that to be a curious omission, that he's just going around telling people dropping facts on people. I don't doubt that he's right. I just wish he gave us a little bit more. And maybe he will in future episodes.
Well, and sometimes he does, like that motorcycle thing, right? And then sometimes he doesn't, like when Donna leaves the roadhouse with a greaser and Dale Cooper's like, "No, she's going to go meet another motorcyclist." And it's
right.
Like, how did he know that? Exactly.
Yeah, so I kind of wish there was a little more insight there. And there's a lot of interesting threads introduced, right? It seems the most clear thread is this idea that a serial killer who had previously killed someone a year earlier, I think, in the same area, has also killed Laura Palmer. Like, that seems to me the clearest thing, the clearest clue of what is going to happen in the show, where it's headed. Mm-hmm. I anticipate many other threads will be introduced in the future. But, I guess, you know, you already know a lot of what happens, but putting yourself back into the mindset of someone who didn't know, would there be a thread that intrigued you the most, Joanna?
You know, the figure who I find like kind of most two figures that I find the most alluring. One is sort of James Hurley, who was like Laura's secret boyfriend who winds up in jail. And I think like he's played by the actor James Marshall. And I think all your criticisms of the Bobby Briggs character are correct. But when you see the Bobby Briggs character acting like insanely larger than life, barking at the James character who looks like a kicked puppy, like in jail, like I'm really curious to see how that dynamic plays out. If I hadn't seen this show before, and then also the Audrey Horne character, just because Sherilyn Fenn is like so strange and evocative, and this whole thing she does to like ruin the big business deal and all of that is very curious and interesting, and her reaction to Laura's death is also curious and intriguing. So those two figures. What about you?
Yeah, I think just the procedural aspects of who killed her and. I'm just, having not watched the show at all, just so curious about how this whole thing is going to spin wildly out of control. Because I think that so far it feels like a very controlled burn right now. It feels mm-hmm. completely in control. What I've heard is that does not remain the case, that it becomes more and more crazy, more and more insane, and that Twin Peaks is kind of one of the legendary shows that didn't really know how to end well. from what I recall, of which there have been many shows, right? Think of two other shows I mentioned earlier, Lost and the X-Files, which have a lot of complainers for how those shows ended.
Well, you know, if we get to go move forward with this podcast, which I hope we do, we can really examine sort of what happened, because it's sort of it's not only an interesting look at sort of the network system at the time, but also why David Lynch has so much power and control over Twin Peaks this time, right, with Showtime. Why Showtime is treating David Lynch the way they are this time versus what happened in the 90s.
Right.
So, you know, that should be a fun sort of extracurricular conversation to have if we move forward with the podcast.
Indeed. All right. Well, if there's nothing – oh, one last thing I want to mention about this episode, Joanna. The music. Very, very interesting. Yeah. And there's this kind of piano score that plays over the opening credits that then returns. And I thought it was an odd choice, you know, because it felt to me – you know, my mom plays piano in a church choir. Mm-hmm. And it felt like music she would play on Sunday morning in a celebratory fashion. And it's the same music they played when Laura Palmer's dad, Leland Palmer, I think played by Ray Wise, finds out that Laura's dead, right?
On numerous other
occasions. They play that music during very tragic moments, but the music almost sounds happy. And then they kind of change it into like minor keys or unhappy. They kind of tweak it as the episode goes on. It just felt to me kind of odd. I loved the jazz, kind of jazzy drum solo stuff that goes on during the investigation parts. That felt to me pretty iconic. You know, even though it's not a visual thing I'm talking about, it felt to me like, oh, a guy solving – I feel like I've seen versions of that on TV or in films where someone solving a crime or riffing on something is then set to that kind of music. But I just thought the music was interesting. Did you find it to be weird? Do you think it matched perfectly with what was going on screen?
Well, what's funny is the theme song – you're talking about the main theme song, right? That plays over – yeah. The theme song is so sort of iconic to me at this point that what is even – actually more startling is when it's turned into a pop song in the episode, like in the Roadhouse. The song is called Falling. It was composed by Angelo Badalamenti, and the lyrics are written by David Lynch himself. And it's performed in the episode in the Roadhouse scene. So when it's a theme, like an instrumental theme song that you're so used to hearing the theme song, and then you hear it with lyrics and sort of fully orchestrated, that to me was sort of the most startling music moment. Mm-hmm. You're right that it's an odd music choice, but it's so, to me at this point, so linked with Twin Peaks that I have a hard time really identifying its oddity, other than to say, what you're saying about your mom playing it in a sort of like uplifting Sunday morning church kind of way, I think feeds back into what we were saying about like this, having roots in 80s soapy melodrama, and B, Lynch really enjoying contrasting those uplifting imagery with something very dark. And so the fact that it's playing when Leland Palmer finds out that his daughter is dead, to me actually kind of makes sense. Does that, you know, that weird contrast makes sense to me. So
fair enough. Well, Joanna, this has been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Talk about this with you. And PeaksTV.com is where you can go if you want to support this podcast. Thanks for tuning in, listening to this. And we hope to join you for a full Twin Peaks recap podcast starting on May 21st when the show returns to Showtime.